Taz, welcome to the show.
Good morning. It's nice to be here.
Thank you very much. We always start our podcast off the same way. So who are you and what problem do you solve?
I don't think you start it at the same time every way, because obviously this is the first time I've done it. But I'll start it this way, which is my name is Anthony Tazgall, known as Taz. I worked for many years in ad agency as an account planner, strategist, working with clients, helping solve their problems about brand positioning, targeting. Did that for quite a while until I got bored with the fact that the answer to every question was a 40-second television commercial. And also, I just wanted to get into other areas like training and speaking, writing. So for quite a while now, I've been on my own. I have a company name called POV. And the acronym I use, which conveniently sort of summarizes what I do, is trainer, author, speaker. So those are the sort of three main areas I sort of cover. Probably about 70-80% is training, working with clients, local, global, whatever. Fair amount of speaking at conferences, then obviously the books, of which there are now six. And the three areas which hopefully we'll cover in any way of this chat is behavioral economics, why people make the choices that they do. Storytelling, what does that mean in terms of communications and insight? Well, that pretty much summarizes my entire life, actually, whatever it was, for just seconds.
Okay. And broadly speaking, for someone who's just tuned in, what are the potential, if you're a doctor, what are the potential symptoms that they might be experiencing that would make it worthwhile staying tuned for the rest of the conversation?
I think if you're suffering from a lack of empathy, for example, if your communications, your brands, your whatever it is, if you don't think that they're working very well, I think I'm not going to help treat you in that way as well. But also, I think if you suffer from a disease called curiosity, which I don't know if it's a disease, probably isn't really, it's probably something more positive. But I think that's sort of the thing that's been my motor in training and writing, which is what's interesting, what piques my curiosity. And what's going to change the way that we do communications, brands, the way that we deal with each other, the way we expect influence decision. So if anyone's interested in any of those things,
hold on and keep listening.
Good stuff. Taz, it's great to have you on the podcast. Since setting up a business, I've had lots and lots of conversations with my dad, who doesn't understand a lot of business lingo. So if he's listening to this episode and he's thinking, right, behavioral economics, what is that? What does it mean? How does it affect people? Give us everything in a nutshell.
Okay. First of all, if he hears business lingo, I tell him not to. Because if lingo means jargon, one of my eternal missions is to try and rid our world of as much jargon as possible. And in fact, in my storytelling training, I do an exercise called Junk the Jargon, where I get clients and companies to sort of explicitly bring out the jargon and then we try and throw it in the bin. One example of which, just to follow this point up, a while ago I went to see an ad agency that I knew and she brought me in and said, look, we might want you to do something for us because one of our planners has gone on maternity leave. We've got a pitch coming up and we might even need some training. So I'm not quite sure what we want you to do. But she didn't actually say, we're not quite sure what you want to do. She actually said, I'm finding it hard solutionizing you. And after my jaw had recovered from the floor hitting the floor, I thought, I'm not sure I want to be solutionized. So if your dad does hear any lingo like that, tell him not to. But let me explain what behavioral economics is. So behavioral economics is not a great brand name for it, frankly. What it actually is understanding how human beings make decisions. Certainly in the world that I come from, which is about influencing people, suggesting they buy one brand rather than another brand, or choose a particular product, service, political party issue. It would be really good, wouldn't it, if we had an idea of how actually to influence people, since the ad industry and all of its support, like market research, pretty much dedicated to that. But for a lot of time, it's just very subjective. You know, we think this will work, we think we should try this, and you know, a client might say this, an agency might say, why it's all terribly. So a few years ago, 20 years ago, probably I heard about two people, one called Daniel Kahneman, who passed away sadly, and his colleague, Amos Tversky. And they did lots of research. There were psychologists. And they did lots of research about how people actually seem to make decisions rather than what economists thought, which is that we only make decisions which are purely rational, which maximize what they call maximize our utility. I don't have that about you or your dad, Jack, but I don't wake up in the morning thinking, right, today I'm going to maximize my utility. Behavioral economics is about actually understanding how we make decisions, how our brain often doesn't allow us to make the decisions that we think we're making. So if we think we're being very conscious and rational and independent, most of the time we're not. Most of the time our decisions are unconscious, they're emotional, and there's shortcuts. And even more worrying, if you believe in free will, a lot of the time we don't even know we're making those decisions. So for me, that's what behavioral economics is. And it goes back to that word I just said, that curiosity. Because if you're remotely curious in human beings and how they think and behave, and why we don't often do what we say we're going to do, behavioral economics really delves into that. So it's both very practical, but also, I think, really fascinating. So if that's not going to put your dad off forever, Jack, that's what I'd say to him.
He's still here. So can you think of anything anecdotally, or maybe any examples of kind of irrational decision-making that you might have seen in well-known brands or marketing? Anything that people go, oh, that's how I've been tricked, or that's how they've got me?
I'm trying to avoid using the word tricked or manipulated, but I know what you mean. What I do say is that an awful lot of companies and brands, and also, frankly, when I look at teaching and educating, my lecture, an awful lot of people think that their job is simply to transmit facts. So an awful lot of companies, and I'm going to try not to name and shame, but hopefully people listening will, you know, understand. An awful lot of companies basically think their goal is to go out there and tell people, do this, do that, or this is what we are, this is how wonderful we are. And in the same way that if you go, for example, on a date, you don't want to just meet someone who says, I'm fantastic, I'm really lovely, very handsome, and you should go out with me forever. It doesn't work. So an awful lot of communication, and again, whether it companies, whether it government, whether it's education, gets that wrong and thinks it's simply a matter of communicating with what we call in behavioral economics system two, the rational part of the brain. Now, I'm not going to say that's wrong, but we have to engage it, system one, which is the unconscious emotional part of the brain. So brands that do it well, so the Nikes, the Apples, the Specsavers, the Tescos, understand that you need to influence people by affecting their emotion. So where we go wrong is when we simply try and tell people things and facts, especially in a very sort of didactic, you must listen to me, sort of parent-child way. And again, if either of you are parents or anyone who's listening who's got kids, you can tell me what happens when you tell children what to do. But it's the same when we grow up. Our brain doesn't react to that. So it's about understanding the power of emotions and making sure that there's a sort of balance between fact and emotion. So that's one answer to your question, I think.
So at time of recording, we've just had Christmas, which is great time of year in terms of advertising becomes very story-based. John Lewis springs to mind, making us all cry when the John Lewis advert goes live. But there's some stories that get lost in the ether, some that just don't seem to stick. So what's the difference between a story that sticks and a story that doesn't?
The first thing, you need to read my books, but obviously. Just sort of very broadly, the reason why, and it's funny that this John Lewis thing has become a thing now and it's a Christmas. Because, you know, stories are not just for Christmas, I'd like to say. I should use that again. Because the fact is our brain is designed to see the world through stories, to understand the world through stories, to frame and compartmentalize the world through story. So again, one of the reasons that we teach children through the medium of storytelling, and we grow up and then keep doing that, but then sometimes we stop in our business world, is that we just forget the power of story. So what John Lewis had done, and obviously other brands do it as well, is just to create something which is based on real human character. And once you empathize with human character, though people who have goals and aspirations and fears and hopes, and once you create conflict between, for example, what they're trying to achieve and what stands in their way, or you've got the bones of a story, but the main thing above all, and again, I'll use the magic number three because we talk a lot about threes in storytelling. So, Veni, Vidi, Vici, Liberté, Galate, Fraternité, three wise men, three blind mice. Number of times you're a lady. So the three main things I'd say about story. One is emotions, which I've just talked about. Stories involve our emotions. You can't have a story if you're not involving, engaging people's emotions. The second one is, again, as just mentioned, is empathy, because we empathize with human beings much more than we do with objects or certainly abstractions or companies. And the third thing, as I say, is having heroes and villains. So those characters, and again, we talk about brand character for that reason. We can relate to them because they are human beings that we can, again, relate to. So John Lewis, you know, everyone talks about it at Christmas, but good brands and good organizations, good political parties. You know, there are some parties at the moment, for example, the UK government, trying to be lacking a narrative. The ones that do it well understand that stories can do that. They can engage our brain, make us care, as well as think. So those are the ones that do it well. And I think, again, they've become, in a sense, a bit formulaic, or John Lewis ones. And other companies do it around Christmas because I suppose, you know, we're all together at Christmas and we're... But as I said, really, it's something that most good organizations and brands should be doing all the time, which is having a brand story and a brand narrative, and making sure that what they create isn't just factual, lowest common denominator messaging. So that's, as I say, that's something that comes to the fore at Christmas, but I think it's something, as I say, that should be something that companies do as a matter of course.
Wonderful. So there's stories feel like that's the way we've evolved and communicated and told each other complex ideas, and that's the way that they've resonated much easier than being didactic parent-teacher kind of set up to the child. The other thing that springs to mind is the idea of like a tribal bias. So you are then pigeonholed in, this is my story, I relate to it, so now I am Waitrose. But then over here, this person is now Aldi. So what do stories do in terms of putting us into these nice, neat little boxes?
That's a good point, because one of the things that I say, as I said, we were designed firstly to understand the world through stories. But as human beings, we are designed to live in tribes and groups. So one of the things that tribes and groups and in-groups need, and again, this sort of pretty much covers both behavioral economics and storytelling, is we need stories that bind us together. So whether it's our faith, our religion, our football team, whatever it might be, we need those stories that create that sort of in-group mentality. And occasionally that can be quite damaging, because if you create an in-group, often there's an out-group. But the point is that stories are very, very good at that. And as you say, whether you're a Waitrose person or a Guardian person or a Nike or I'm an Apple person, you know, watching you on an Apple, I've got my iPhone a bit. And an awful lot of what that brand means and what those things mean is rooted in those shared experiences and stories. So I've probably got to pop into the Apple store at Brent Cross tomorrow, I think. But if you look at them, they two are geniuses. They had a genius bar. And you think, that's a great piece of language. They're not just tech people, they're actually sort of geniuses. And the Apple tribe, you know, there are very, very clear sort of tribal, you know, links. And a lot of those things, and that's what Steve Jobs was so brilliant at doing, was understanding why stories work at that level, rather than just going on and on about tech and spec, which doesn't just happen in the tech world. I work with pharmaceutical companies, I work with retail, whatever. And they all have their equivalent of just boring people to death with spec and numbers and science. And again, I'm not saying that's not important, because it is, but a lot of the time, A, it becomes too jargony, again, you know, for Jack's dad. B, actually, companies often think that what they think is a significant technical difference isn't, when you ask the person in the street. And then thirdly, as I say, they just underestimate all the other stuff, which is the emotional and the story. And and Nike and Apple and all those obvious brands and Specsavers we have sort of worked with, which is why I keep dropping them. Just are brilliant at realizing that you need all the other stuff. It isn't just sort of soft, pink, fluffy stuff. It's the stuff that makes people feel something about your company or your brand or whatever it might be. So, yeah, that's how I would say that sort of behavioral economics, storytelling, and tribal stuff all overlaps.
With the storytelling and the psychology side of things, Taz, it makes me think about, like, the way that we consume stories. Obviously, when we think about tribal, we'd be sat around a fire and we'd be talking about our day, and then we'd move through to books and then films. And now it feels like we're in a time where you can enjoy a story in the space of 30 seconds and then swipe to find another story. So I guess in terms of, like, generational, what are some of the constants in storytelling and psychology, and what are some of the things that you've found maybe in the last 5-10 years that are changing?
That's a really good question, and I get asked this a lot. I was actually in Kuwait at the beginning of December doing a talk out of there, and in New York in, I think it was September, and funnily enough, exactly the same question got asked. And part of it is they were actually, you know, TikTok, Instagram, everything's different now, because surely stories don't work in the same way. And my answer to that, which I don't think I'd change very much, is that channels change, media change, but stories are always with us. We've always, since we first evolved language, we've created groups. The idea of storytelling, as I've just said, with tribes and understanding the world and defining the world, that hasn't gone away. Yes, the way that which they're expressed has changed. So you can still tell a story in 30 seconds. You can begin a story and create a story in 5 to 10 seconds. And a lot of the things that do succeed in those sort of new media work because they create one of the big six emotions. And often it's surprise. So I think when my kids are showing me stuff on TikTok or whatever, a lot of it is either humorous or it's surprising or it's both. But the point is they're creating that sort of emotional connection. So I think that's often, I think, the common denominator for stories. So, and people often say to me, oh, well, you know, everything's got to be short now. To which I'll say, well, okay, look at some of the Booker Prize winners that are 400 pages. Or look at people that will binge watch 8 hours of Squid Game. Was it 6, 7 hours Squid Game? People will watch as much as they want, no matter how long it is, if it's good, if it's interesting, if it's a great story. And equally, if something is 10 seconds long and it's rubbish, we'll turn it off. So I don't want to necessarily say long form good, short form bad, because it's not as simple as that. It's about how you tell a story. And I think, again, writers, copywriters, storytellers, they know, and that's the challenge, is how do you work across different media? But my point is all those principles of storytelling, I think, are pretty much timeless. And I don't think those change. And I do a lot of this stuff globally. And yes, there are cultural differences. But there is no country I visited that doesn't understand storytelling or doesn't use storytelling. So I think it is, as I say, pretty much universal for those reasons.
So if I'm getting ready to incorporate storytelling as a skill, maybe it's within a pitch, maybe it's on a podcast, maybe it's to motivate the team, whatever it is. If I was to fail and it was awful and I did everything that you could do wrong with storytelling, what are some of those things that I'd be doing?
I think I would sort of say if you're doing it wrong, it's probably not storytelling. Because what I do find, as I say, which is the opposite. So the first book I wrote, the storytelling book, which is 10 years old this year, unbelievably, and is still on sale after having sold 40,000 copies. So I'd have three parts. The first part is where we're going wrong in our communication. The fact that it's become obsessed with messaging and facts and telling people things, again, as I mentioned. And also a bit of a rant that I have about metrics. I think our world, the marketing and comms world, has become obsessed with KPIs and metrics. And my feeling is that hasn't led to anything particularly better. Just because we have big data and lots of metrics, I'm not sure it's made our communications any more insightful. So the first part is where we've gone wrong. And I talk about this acronym I use called DRIP, Data Rich Insight Poor. Well, I think that's the world that we've created, and the world I call arithmocracy, obsessed with numbers and messaging. But that's the sort of setup. The second part of the book is, how does storytelling work? And then the rest of the book is, here's some tips and tricks. So I think my sort of feeling really is that people may say they're doing storytelling, but most of the time they're not. Occasionally clients will say to me, look at our website, look at all our material, we do stories. And often I'll say to them, those aren't stories, those are case studies. And the case study goes along these lines. You know, somebody came to us, we did this, it was brilliant, huzzah. And that's not a story, that's just a case study. You need, as I say, you need humans, you need character. So I do sometimes find clients saying, yeah, we are doing all this. And I look at it and say, no, you think you might be, but that's because you don't really understand how stories work. Or maybe you're being sort of forced by other sort of higher powers within the organization to do too much of this factual, didactic, informative sort of approach. So it's not, as I say, I think people do it right. I think they aren't doing it at all. Or if they are doing it, you know, they're just not really, as I say, they're not really committed to it. So that, I think that's where probably people are going wrong, Jack.
So then linking this all together, what are some interesting, shocking, mind-blowing things about the way cognitive biases fit into all this, things that are happening at the unconscious level?
Yeah, I think one of the things that never ceases to amaze me is when you look at, for example, what people say they are doing. So one of the biases we have, obviously, is we think that we are rational and independent. So we think that I'm going to do this, I'm going to choose it, and it's going to be. And a lot of the times, the decisions we make have already been made before, as I say, because our brain, they're called heuristics, they're called shortcuts. So what our brain does to save energy, because the brain's main goal is not to make the best decision, to make the most effortless decision, because it saves the brain energy, which it can then expend on more important things like keeping us alive. So I think one of the biases that we are all prey to is the thought that we are making a very serious, you know, like very, you know, weighed up, Rodin-like decision at a particular moment, when actually what's happening is our brain is just on a repeat path. It's doing what it's always done before because it's easy. Now, I'll give you an example. I'm going to show you this. I'm on audio. I'm holding a cup of tea, right? So I'm a huge tea drinker. I don't like coffee. So I understand how anyone can drink coffee. It's burnt mud. Though I drink Earl Grey tea. That's my tipple. And I even refer to it in one of the books. I thanked the Earl of Grey, everything he's done for me. And I'll tell you how I chose a particular type of Earl Grey. So many years ago, when I was working in town at an ad agency, a new chain opened up called Presse Manger. And it was right near where I was working. So I went in there and thought, right, I've never been here, it's new, I'll order an Earl Grey tea. Black, obviously. For anyone listening, I don't believe in capital punishment, with one exception, which is for people who put milk in Earl Grey tea. So I ordered an Earl Grey tea, and I thought, oh, this is really nice. And that was many, many years ago, and I still get my Earl Grey from Pret a Manger. Now, do I make a conscious, rational decision? Do I think, oh, maybe I should try Starbucks one? No, why? I can't be bothered. My brain can't be bothered. Are there better Earl Greys out there? Quite possibly. But my brain is biased to what it's done before, to save energy and make simpler, more effortless decisions. I think one of the things we don't understand about our own decisions, and one of the reasons why brand owners and other organizations go wrong, is they assume that if they launch a new product or make a new claim, that we will automatically go out and evaluate that claim. And I see this often when brands go wrong, when launches fail, and it's because we haven't understood the power of the brain investing in what it's already done. This is sometimes called loss aversion. So your brain hates losing way more than it likes winning. So if it means losing something that you've invested in, like, you know, I've always loved this Earl Grey, your brain goes, why would you spend all the time looking for a new one? So often that's a bias that companies just don't realize the power of. And the evidence suggests that actually for something to be better for the brain to choose, it's got to be 2.5 times better than what we're already doing. That's one of my favorite examples. And it's an anecdote that, as I say, I can relate to with my old Grey tea. Because I could go out and spend lots of time choosing up the... I can't be bothered. Quite happy with it, really. So.
That's a beautiful example. I hope you get sponsored after this goes out.
Well, North and Twinings is out there or anymore. Always available.
Yeah. It sparked a thought then around... You talked about product launches. When we think about offers... So offers, there's obviously all sorts of different schools of thought. There's free first, there's a bit of downloadable content first, there's having 3 different offers and people tend to go for the middle one. Yeah. What's true? What can you tell us about the way people should be thinking about crafting the offer?
And there's a huge variety of ways in which behavioral economics can sort of affect that. As you say, framing, so you actually give people 3 and you deliberately frame one that people won't go for in order to get the middle one. So 2 examples of that. I used to work on Peugeot many years ago in the car market, which was always amusing. I didn't particularly like car, but I was always the sort of non-petrol head. And one of the reasons why car brands, that they still do actually, always used to launch a sort of go faster stripe limited edition. Was not to sell that, but to make that a sort of high point so that the rest of the variants would actually look more desirable. So again, that's something that companies do, which is you automatically create something which is beyond most people and aspirational, but it makes the other offers slightly more desirable. Then you've got things to do with numbers. So we know that if 5.99 is better than 6, because there's something again about that seems slightly cheaper, even though it's only 1p or 1 cent different. There's something, again, that the brain just compartmentalizes it differently. But one thing I would say about offers, which I suppose just goes back to my sort of brand strategist background, which isn't necessarily a behavioral economics point or even a storytelling point. I think it's more of a marketing point, which is about loyalty. So again, what behavioral economics would tell us, I think, actually, is that loyalty is about emotions and trust and all those sorts of things. And the problem with relying on offers, and I've worked with many FMCG retailing brands that would do that, was it was an old sort of myth, you know, maxim, you can't buy loyalty. I think sometimes the problem with offers is that companies that get too obsessed with offers, what you end up doing is you make your brand too tactical. And again, both in terms of behavioral economics and loyalty and emotions, but also having a brand story, those I think are things which are much more strategic and long term. So almost as a sort of counterpoint to what you're saying about offers, I'm always aware of saying, yes, you can design sort of clever offers, but don't get carried away by them, because they do get in the way sometimes of creating sort of real long-term strategic value for the brand or the company. So that's the sort of having my cake and eating it a little bit in there.
And then when you think about the brands that are getting it right, so we're operating in a market where attention's the new oil. You've also got to get the right offer. There's seasonal things. There's news cycles. There's changes in government.
Yeah.
What are the brands that have got it right through all the changes? Who jumps to mind as that's a really, really good example of someone who's doing the whole thing?
Yeah, I've mentioned the obvious ones, the Nikes, the Apples. As I said, I like to mention Specsavers. Before, by the way, I'm going to steal my own thunder. I mentioned attention, and I have an expression that I've been using now over the years. It allows me to talk about insights, which I haven't talked very much about. So in the book that I wrote 2023, in the Insight book, so I'm fascinated what insight is and how to get it, and slightly irritated that research companies think that data is the same as insight. So an awful lot of insight is serendipities, is happy accidents and things coming together and making new connections. So this happened to me a while ago. So I was writing a speech for a client. And as you said, I was talking about attention. I was talking about the brain, stuff that I've mentioned already. I was just typing something and I was writing the term attention span. And if anyone listening, if you look at your keyboard, you'll see the letters N and M are next to each other. And I accidentally typed attention spam, then M. I've now fallen in love with it as an expression. Because I think that's what I say to most people who are in any form of communication. Your goal is to evade going into attention spam. Because we like to think, don't we, that everything we say goes from our attention inbox into our audience's attention inbox. But we know, for all the reasons I've mentioned, whatever percentage, I don't know, 80, 90% will go into attention spam. So, and again, going back to Jack's question about different media, whatever medium channel you're looking at, whether it's long form or whether it's, you know, TikTok, it's still got to avoid going into people's attention span. So, the reason why I mentioned Specsavers is I just thought it's a really interesting case study, because what they did was, rather than saying we're all about vision, we're about science and technical and offers, and they do stuff on offers. Again, what they did was create a story and a series of sort of brand stories, a little anecdote about what happens if your eyesight doesn't work. And we can all remember them. And some of them have been going for 20 years. And I work with Graham Daldry, who was the executive creative director at Specsavers, who came up with a line, should have gone to Specsavers, and understood the power of that idea and the power of that story. And as I say, the reason I like that is it's not an obvious one. It's not one of the big sexy brands. And they've had a fairly good budget and they've advertised quite consistently. But the reason I like referring to it is when Vision Express, which was one of their rivals, decided to sort of take them on, they came up with a campaign which said, "We take vision seriously." And the idea was to say, you know, Specsavers, it's all jokey, funny, you know, don't listen to them. We're really serious. And no one remembers that campaign. And everyone remembers should have gone to Specsavers. And the reason I talk about it is a couple of reasons. One is it shows everything I talked about, emotions, humor, surprise. Secondly, it shows that often beats the serious stuff about science. And you know, they do that. And they have, you know, obviously all the people are, you know, very good expert opticians, ophthalmologists. But that's not what they talk about. They talk about the sort of the actual benefit, which is, you know, what happens if your eyesight starts deteriorating. But the third thing, which again is a really fascinating topic for me, is brand personality, which I think doesn't get enough sort of publicity. When brands look at their message, they always talk again about the very factual, dry, this is what we do, we'll make stuff. And a huge amount of brands succeed because of their character, the brand personality and character. Virgin, for example, I think understands that, the whole slightly rock and roll, slightly, you know, up yours approach that they've always had. And that personality perspective, which is all about humor and lightness and charm, I think a lot of clients would have said, "Oh, no, we can't do that. We're, you know, this is about our vision. Your vision is serious. It's important. We can't do humor." And I do sometimes say to my clients, you know, you need to just lighten up a bit. And even though I say, "Oh, yes, but we're pharmaceutical," or there are still other personalities that you can look at than always going for a very lowest common denominator, bland, vanilla, clinical approach. So that's the reason that, as I like to talk about Specsavers.
Let's go a bit deeper on that, Tad, because when you talk about like personalities and the rock and roll, like I love all stuff like that. And I think it's very, not easy for brand, but if it is something like Specsavers a bit more comedic or whatever, it's easier to be a bit outlandish. Are there any other examples that you can think of personalities where they've nailed it, but it's maybe not nailed it because they're the loudest in the room or the most out there? It's just for other reasons that they've kind of nailed on their personality.
I'll give you another one, which is, again, one I worked on and was very sort of closely involved with. So in 2021, I worked with the Royal Albert Hall in London, which in their terms, jargon, is an iconic venue. And it was the 150th anniversary. I won't go through the stories, we haven't got time. But I'd ended up meeting their marketing director a few years before that. And she said, look, I really like this. I did a talk about storytelling. And she said, would you like to come and help us tell our story for our 150th anniversary? I thought, yes, please. So I spent a lot of time interviewing their council, their marketing people, the tour guides. I interviewed people that performed at the Royal Albert Hall. Fantastic, you know, gig to do. And one of the clients said, oh, what we really need is like a line at the end that says, you know, we've been around for 150 years and so much more to come. And I looked at that and I thought, yeah, it's okay. And people I put it in front of said, yeah, it's okay. And when I came to do a presentation to their council, and the council members at the Royal Albert Hall, hopefully not listening, are all of a certain type. You know, they were sort of very dry. They were not necessarily marketing or comms people. And they were all male, very sort of a certain age. And my clients said, well, they're going to go for something, you know, very dry. But in the presentation I gave, I did a word cloud. I did, look, just to show you, here are some words that describe the hall, the Royal Albert Hall, that people have used to me. And I put them together, right? And it was a whole cloud of like 40 or 50 words. And then what I did was I put the next chart. I said, look, actually, you can summarize them in three words. These are the three words that I would say summarize how people feel about the Royal Albert Hall. And the first one was eclectic, because they put on lots of shows. They put 400 shows a year. They put all sorts of the proms. They've had Frank Sinatra, Einstein, all sorts of very, very diverse. The second word I put was eccentric, because everyone knew, especially visitors, tourists, it's got a quite eccentric personality, Victor and Albert, the English quirkiness about it. And the third word was when I spoke to people that performed. And they said, you know, we performed all over the world, like Cirque du Soleil, Clapton, whatever. But there's something quite electric about the Royal Albert Hall. So I just had this chart. It just said those three E's, eccentric, eclectic, and electric. And to my utter surprise, all the council went, yes, that's it. That's us. That's what we want to do. And myself and my client just literally sort of had to get off the ground. Thought, well, that's not what we thought was coming. I said, oh, yeah, all these lines that other people look, we're a bit boring. We like those words. And the CEO actually went on ITV News, because it was during COVID, unfortunately, and said, yes, this is how we see our 150th anniversary celebration, eclectic, eccentric, and electric. I thought, oh, okay. So going back to your original question, that's another example where sometimes we've got to avoid just deferring to something which is factual and the lowest common denominator. Because they did sort of on their materials, they did say, yeah, we're 150 years old and whatever. But they were under no illusions. That was not going to really move anyone. But having those words, and also the internal staff really liked it as well. Having those words and using it as the brief for the agency that created their 150th celebration, which was sadly cut short because of COVID, that was much more meaningful and much more emotional and much more motivating. And again, I'd like clients to just look at that. And as you said, it doesn't always have to be humor or fun, because that wasn't particularly fun. But there are just so many other sort of emotional characteristics and moods that affect how people see other people or brands or companies or governments or politicians. And I think sometimes that we become so afraid of stepping out of our little safe box, where we don't say anything that offends anyone or say anything that, you know, really steps out of line, that we just don't allow ourselves to think a bit more imaginatively. So that's why I bang on about personality so much.
I love that. And the power of three rears its head again.
Power of three again. Thank you for that.
There we go. Taz, I want to, while we've got you, I know we don't have loads and loads of time, I do want to go deeper into insight. So let me ask you this. Where do the majority of companies go wrong when it comes to insights? And what questions could they be asking themselves to get better answers?
Yeah, this might be, I have to do this in the director's cut or the bonus edition or something, because it's such a... let me give you my sort of brief thing on insight. As I mentioned before, I think too often insight has become conflated with just data. And an insight has to be surprising. So the quote I love using, and it's in the book, Light Book. Any of your viewers, listeners who know Isaac Asimov, who was a scientist and science fiction writer, who wrote Foundation and Empire and also I, Robot. For any younger people listening, he wrote I, Robot, the book, not the film with Will Smith. He had this great saying, which I credit him because obviously it's not mine, but it's a wonderful saying. He said, when scientists come up with a new discovery, they don't go eureka. They say, that's funny. And I always thought that's my favorite go-to definition of an insight. You look at it and you go, oh, that's funny. And it's your head gets caught. You look to the sort of, and because your brain is going, well, hang on, I hadn't thought of it like that before. And I think that's my criterion for if I'm working with a company or a brand or helping to find, does it create that? And again, it's an emotional response, it's a prize. And I think too often clients put in front of me or themselves a list of facts or and they go, that's an insight. I'm going, that's not an insight. That's just a fact about your market or your consumer. And often, and again, in the book, I talk about cream eggs and I talk about hot noodle and I talk about Persil, the dirt is good. The reason is often that an insight is only an insight once you action it. So any washing powder could have said dirt is good. Any toiletry brand could have said, you know, we believe there's no one definition of beauty. But that's what Dove did and that's what Persil did. So often the insight is finding something surprising and new and unexpected and then doing something with it first before anyone else does. But as I said, for me, insight is about having people who aren't just data squirrels. Because yes, data can be the way to insight, but I do resist that assumption that data is the only way to get to insight. The example I gave you of attention spam, you know, there's no data involved in that. It was just a happy coincidence. So I do think we need more creative people or more of a creative attitude or mindset if we're genuinely trying to create insight. Not to say that data people can't do that. I'm sure many of them do and care. But as I say, I think there is another set of characteristics which enable you to sort of find or fall upon insight. And it is a different, as I say, it's a different mindset.
I was just thinking then when you were saying that around the Amazon 4.2 stars review being better than the 5-star review. And on paper, you would think, why would that make sense? Surely perfect is best, but we don't trust perfect.
We don't trust perfect. And again, we've got a couple of minutes, but I'll tell you a great story. Again, it's called the pratfall effect. And it's about don't make things perfect. Human beings don't like perfection, as we just said with that story. And the pratfall effect is a piece of psychology. It's been done many, many times. And one example is where somebody goes up onto a stage, gives a speech. And then the audience rates that person, the speech, their content. But in another condition, a person goes up and before they get on the stage, they slip and fall over as they go up. And then the audience again is asked to rate that speaker and the speech. And guess what? They rate the second person more highly. Because rather than saying, oh, that was terrible, what an idiot, we go, oh, God, that's terrible, it must be awful. Because we empathize with imperfection. So again, I'll say to brands, you know, don't aim for perfection because A, we don't trust things, don't like it. And B, human beings, we understand failure and error. And I'll end up with a bit of etymology because I haven't done any etymology, which is really weird for me. Because I'm a former classicist, a Latin classicist. I'm obsessed with Latin and Greek ancient history. So the word error comes from the word errare in Latin, which means to wander. So the word erratic, you're driving erratically, you're wandering across the road. So I would say an error is not a mistake, it's just wandering. So it doesn't necessarily mean you're making, but you are just wandering away from. And I think that's how we have to see everything we do, actually, that we are wandering. Sometimes that will be a mistake and a failure, but we can't always assume perfection. And companies often do that. It's fine, you know. As long as you understand it and you make explanations or whatever it fits, it's fine. But don't aim to be 100% perfect all the time, because A, you can't, and B, people won't like you for it.
I've just shouted that down. What a lovely reframe. Taz, thank you so much for doing this. I appreciate you sharing the wisdom. I'm feeling full of dopamine and inspiration right now, so thank you very much. If people are listening to this and they say, you know what, I want to learn more about Taz, about your work, where would you say is the best place to start?
I think probably on LinkedIn. I'm Taz Gaultier.
Taz Gaultier, G-A-L at LinkedIn. I do have a nominal presence as Taz Will Heal on Twitter, or X, or whatever we have to call it now. But yeah, LinkedIn's probably the best place. Or if not, just look me up on Amazon, because there's 6 books.
Hopefully 7 coming soon.
Beautiful. We'll put links to all of them. Appreciate your time, Taz. All the best.
Thank you.
Cheers. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.